from fire victims, as well as $400 million in claims from the mudslides.
Recent changes to federal regulations help protect ground and surface water from toxic pollutants. It's time for Current Cast.
Cole Ash goes to court on this Current Cast. When coal is burned for power, a residue called coal ash is left behind.
It contains a slew of toxic pollutants such as arsenic, cadmium, and selenium.
Lisa Hallowell of the nonprofit Environmental Integrity Project says utilities used to frequently dispose of coal ash in unlined ponds that could leak into ground and surface water. But in 2015, coal ash disposal was federally regulated. New impoundments must be lined to minimize risk.
We finally do have federal regulations, which is great.
And a recent court decision mandates that older unlined impoundments must retrofit or close,
which will be safer for all of the communities that live near these sites.
Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, online at currentcast.org.
A new report on rising sea levels indicates that by the end of this century, water damage in California will be, quote, far more devastating than the worst earthquakes and wildfires in state history, end quote. The report by U.S. Geological Survey scientists examined sea level rise combined with storms, wave action, cliff erosion, beach loss, and other coastal threats across California. It found that the number of people exposed to danger is 3 times greater than previous models that considered only sea level rise. More than 500,000 Californians and $150 billion in property are at risk of flooding along the coast by 2100. That's equal to 6% of the state's gross domestic product and comparable to the damage done by Hurricane Katrina. Researchers said that even a small shift in sea level rise could launch a new range of extremes that Californians would have to confront every single year. Anyone with beachfront property is going to be hardest hit. The study says not only will these events continue along the coast, but they can amplify each other as the sea continues to rise.
Intoxicated, a new study finds the weed killer, glyphosate, in major brands of beer and wine. Here's more from H2O Radio.
Stopping off with friends for a beer after work or sipping a glass of wine with dinner doesn't usually raise concerns about pesticides, but a new study shows that your favorite beverage may contain the main ingredient in the weed killer Roundup.
A lot of us, you know, when we're having a beer or a glass of wine, we're not really thinking, could this stuff have a potentially toxic pesticide in it? Or we're having a good time, right?
That's Kara Cook-Schultz, Toxics Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG. She's the author of a new report that tested 14 beers, a cider, and 5 wines right off the shelf to see if they had the pesticide glyphosate in them. The beers included well-known brands like Coors Light, Budweiser, Fat Tire, and Heineken. And the wines they tested were recognized names like Sutter Home and Behringer. And the results?
There is significant amounts of glyphosate in beer and wine.
Of the beers and wines tested, only one, Peak Beer, brewed in Maine, had no glyphosate. Even the organic brands had it. However, there's good news.
The amounts that you would drink on an everyday basis are probably not going to harm you. But what we're trying to get across to people is if you have Roundup in your beer and wine, and you have it in your Cheerios in the morning, and you have it in almost all, you know, your ice cream at night, and almost all the foods that you're eating, and you're spraying it in the garden, that you are exposing yourself to quite a lot of glyphosate on an everyday basis.
The toxicity of glyphosate is uncertain at best. The World Health Organization's cancer arm found in 2015 that it was a probable carcinogen. 2 years later, California listed it as the same. Then a new report by the World Health Organization said that it was unlikely to be harmful. Nevertheless, France banned a form of Roundup earlier this year. And this month, the city of Lodi, California, immediately stopped its use on playgrounds over persistent concerns about the product's safety. Wine is produced in Lodi, which is east of the famous Napa Valley, where glyphosate is commonly used in vineyards. In a 5-year period ending in 2012, Napa County was among the top in California for rates of kids with cancer. So how does glyphosate get into beer and wine, even organic brands?
When it comes to wine, for non-organic wines, they're spraying in between the vines because they're trying to get rid of weeds that are near the vines.
For beer, some growers spray glyphosate right on the barley used to brew.
They actually will sometimes use Roundup to kill down barley In other words, kill it quickly so that they can dry it out and use it to malt for the beer.
Glyphosate shows up in organic beverages too, but at levels lower than non-organic varieties. Cook Schultz suspects glyphosate was in the soil before the farm went organic, or it's in the water used to irrigate crops. In case you're not a beer drinker, generally it's made from four basic ingredients: barley, hops, yeast, and water. The Brewers Association said in a statement that they don't want glyphosate used on any raw brewing material and noted that the barley grower organizations are strongly against its use.
It's disappointing and makes me a little bit angry, to be honest.
That's Elon Walski, co-owner of Coalition Brewing in Portland, Oregon.
You know, we work really, really hard to use the best brewing ingredients that we can.
It's frustrating to Walski that farms that don't actively use the chemicals may still have glyphosate showing up in their crops.
There's an expectation, and I think a really reasonable expectation, in craft beer that it's made using these high-quality ingredients.
Cook Schultz wants the EPA, FDA, and the Department of Agriculture to test beer and wine and ban glyphosate until it's proven safe. Until then, she recommends that consumers ask for organic beers and wines to lower their exposure.
You can also talk to your brewer and let them know that this is a concern for you. Taking this concern to these brewers, I think, actually could really affect the industry.
PERG is asking for growers to stop spraying glyphosate on or near their fields, and for brewers and vintners to test their own products. While the study is not a full scientific review of the beverage industry, it does alert the public that beer and wine may have more in them than refreshment. To see the full PERG report, go to our website at h2oradio.org. From Denver, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Right to Survive. Then at 7, it's Labor in 2, followed by Hard Knock Radio with Davey D. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy, low of 34 with light and variable winds. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 53 and winds around 6 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1868, the first impeachment trial of a U.S. president, Andrew Johnson, began. The quote of the day is from poet Alice Notley. "It's necessary to maintain a state of disobedience against everything."
Nationwide, 12,000 cases of Pillsbury unbleached all-purpose flour in 5-pound bags are being recalled by Hometown Food Company because of possible salmonella contamination. The announcement was made this morning. The company said that no reports of illness have been made by flour consumers and that the recall is, quote, out of an abundance of caution. The company says it says to look for bags which have been used with Best Buy dates of April 19, 2020 and April 20, 2020.
Officials in San Diego are trying to reunite migrant families, but there are more separations than they realized. Sonia Hudson and Julie Small have the story from the California Report.
A San Diego judge is letting thousands more migrant kids join a class action lawsuit that halted the practice of family separation. The change comes after a report that found that policy started at least a year earlier than the court knew. KQED's Julie Small has more.
When U.S. District Judge Dana Sabraw issued an injunction against family separations last June, he didn't know that thousands more children were likely taken from parents before he issued his order. After a government watchdog recently reported the fact, Sabraw decided those families suffered the same alleged wrong. ACLU attorney Lee Gallant says he hopes the government will now identify all of the families split apart without cause.
We will then contact the families to see whether they've managed to reunify with their children on their own, and if they haven't, what would they like to see happen?
An official with the agency responsible for taking care of migrant children in U.S. custody says 47,000 kids passed through its doors from July 2017 through June of last year, and that all of their files will need to be reviewed. For the California Report, I'm Julie Small.
Florida has revoked hundreds of healthcare professional licenses due solely to student loan defaults. 12 other states, including California, Alaska, and Hawaii, also have the power to strip healthcare professionals of their licenses if they default on their student loans, but have told the SBC investigative team that they had not suspended any licenses over loan defaults in the past 2 years. Montana, Oklahoma, New Jersey, and North Dakota have all repealed similar laws in recent years. In the past 2 years, Florida has revoked the licenses of over 900 registered nurses, certified nurse assistants, opticians, and pharmacists. Frustrated registered nurse Andrea Sandler said about the law, quote, "You take away their license, you take away their way of working. How are you going to get your lump sum? How are you going to get your payment?"
If you think you're having a bad day today, be glad you're not Paul Manafort. This morning, Judge Amy Berman Jackson sentenced Trump's former campaign manager to more than 6 years in prison for a variety of federal crimes. A few minutes later, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged Manafort with 16 state felonies, including mortgage fraud and falsifying business records. Last week, Judge T.S. Ellis sentenced Manafort to 47 months for a different group of federal crimes. While President Trump could pardon the federal sentences, he has no power over any charges that could result from the New York indictments.
And now it's time for today's report from Native National News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Just weeks before the 2018 midterm election in North Dakota, voting rights advocates and tribes faced what seemed like an insurmountable task to reach thousands of tribal members and others who would be turned away at the polls because of a new voter ID law. Reporter Christine Trudeau brings us the first story in a series from North Dakota about how tribal leaders, organizations, and volunteers came together to not only bring Native voters in compliance, but to spark one of the largest Native vote turnouts in the state for a midterm election.
It was just here where the people come and then they bring, get their ballots, their, all the paper, the voting.
That's Darlene Chasing Elk, member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, born and raised here near Fort Yates. Back again at the Yellow House, as it's known, says Chasing Elk, headquarters for the Get Out the Vote effort. It was here that many voters on the reservation got help on updating their IDs with a permanent address and could fill out their absentee ballots.
We were here for like 2 weeks, and it was really awesome. We had a lot of people that helped volunteer and go door to door.
Volunteering alongside many, from the tribe to voting rights organizations like Four Directions to the Lakota People's Law Project and the North Dakota Native Vote, organizers like Nicole Donaghy helped to rally and inform tribal citizens to best equip them on their rights and how to vote with the new laws in place. In Bismarck, Donaghy reflects on Election Day.
I had a team of people that wanted to volunteer down there, and so I rented some SUVs. We met at the Yellow House and joined all of the other canvassers down in Standing Rock.
Donaghy then went to the courthouse.
We put up this big tarp and we stayed outside, and we had like heaters in there. And as people were coming out after they voted, we gave them a "I'm an Indigenous and I vote" sticker.
Later in the day came the blitz, Donaghy says, as volunteers took continuous rounds of buses in and out of districts, offering rides to the polls, staying well into the evening to answer questions for voters.
It was a triumph. They didn't want us to vote. They thought they were going to stop us. You know, I'm Lakota. You don't tell me I can't do something. We'll go and do it. We'll find a way. And that's the resiliency of Native people.
With all of the precincts reporting by the end of the night, says Donaghy, they reached over 10,000 voters across four reservations in the state, including Standing Rock, Turtle Mountain, Spirit Lake, and the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nations. Still, the new voter ID laws stand, despite current legal challenges from the Native American Rights Fund. But organizers maintain a close watch on those cases and the legislature leading up to the 2020 election. For National Native News, I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is in collaboration with the Solutions Journalism Network and Prairie Public Broadcasting. Tribal leaders and heads of national Native organizations are closely watching the Indian child welfare case, Brackeen versus Bernhardt, as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reviews a lower court's decision. Last year, a federal district judge in Texas struck down the Indian Child Welfare Act, a decades-old law intended to keep Native children with Native families, as unconstitutional and race-based. Plaintiffs opposing the law include adoptive parents in states including Texas and Louisiana. Tribes and Native groups say the law protects the interests of Native children. A three-judge panel in New Orleans is hearing oral arguments Wednesday on behalf of two federal agencies and five tribes. Pete Kaiser Yupik from Bethel, Alaska, is the 2019 Iditarod champion. Kaiser and his sled dog team checked into Nome, Alaska early Wednesday morning, winning the more than 1,000-mile race. Kaiser has run the Iditarod since 2010 and has been a top finisher several times. The last Alaska native to win was John Baker from Kotzebue in 2011. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
For Native Americans affected by domestic violence, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline offers peer-to-peer support and resources. It's safe, confidential, and toll-free at 844-7-NATIVE. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Emily Gresham-Beamer, and Emery Mort. Our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Gresham-Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, on The Heather McCoy Show, Heather interviews LA Times sports writer Kevin Baxter, who will discuss the United States women's national team's lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation seeking equal pay. At 11, it's Between the Covers. Then at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, guest Dennis Kitchen talks the past, present, and future of alternative comics. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today, we're airing an excerpt from a compelling special on tribes and treaty rights on the Columbia River, which aired during our International Women's Day special programming.
Today, a speech from Asia Dakota, part of the Oregon High Desert Association's High Desert Speaker Series. Asia, a citizen of the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation, discussed tribes and treaty rights in the Columbia River.
Kothlapam Wayanami, Shechlawe, Inma Numaima, Tinma Wanahitait, Inchnim Wanikshash Tukasauch. Just want to welcome you here tonight. My name is Asia Dakota. Honored to have been asked to be a part of this series. And I'm really just honored as well to be here with you tonight, as well as on behalf of the Oregon Natural Desert Association. So if we can give them another big round of applause, that would be really great. Thank you to Corinne for organizing this event. This has been really great, and for all of you showing up today. I am, as Corinne stated before, I'm a citizen of the Yakima Nation. I grew up in Wapato, Washington, which is on the Yakima Reservation, my entire life. My whole family's still there today. And then I have other tribal lineage on my mother's side with the Cayuse, which is one of the Umatilla tribes located in Pendleton, Oregon, and the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho. On my father's side, I am Turtle Mountain Chippewa, which is from Belcourt, North Dakota. And I'm really just, someone who has spent a lot of time outdoors. I think for my family and for many tribal people, one passing on tradition is is something that's very important to us and integral to who we are. And it's also passing on artifacts or assets that we have. And so this is not just true of actual items. So it's not just true of the horse trappings or the dress itself, but also in our beliefs. So when we talk about what we do, how we do it, certain things, we want to make sure that those things are left for the future generations ahead of us. And so I want to introduce this concept called Tamunwit. And it can be really stated as a natural or unwritten law. It's inherent in our creation story, which I'll discuss a little bit later. And it's also our way of life, how we view the world. It's a part of our culture, our traditions, our religion. And it's really about the reciprocity of responsibility. So my worldview and how I grew up is very much influenced not just by my family and my culture and my tribe, but also about my sense of place. I spent a lot of time growing up in the mountains, by the river, near the streams, close to nature, close to the land that's been there for thousands of years for my people and my families. The second concept I want to introduce is a first foods concept, and this really stems from our creation story. So in our creation story, the Creator called a grand council of all the animals and plants. This is when humans weren't here yet, and they all had voices. And he was preparing the world for humans to come, for the tribes who have been here. And he called them all together and said, you know, these people are going to come, and they're helpless. How can we help them? They're going to need your help. What are we going to do? And the first to come forward was Salmon, or Nusach. And the salmon said, I will give my life for the people so that they will have something to eat. The second was the Yamish, or the deer and elk and the game, who said they would also give themselves up as sustenance, but also as clothing. The third was the bitterroots, or camas, or the medicinal plants. And then the fourth was the Wiwanu, or the huckleberries. And at the center of that is Chush, and that's the water, because water sustains all life. And this is what you might call our first treaty with the Creator, because we have this promise that if these foods take care of us, then it is our responsibility to take care of them. And so when we have our traditional practices, or when we lay all the food on the table at the longhouses, when we have our religious practices every week or for different ceremonies, that's the order in which that we place each of the foods. So the salmon is always water, the salmon, the deer and elk, the bitterroots, and then the huckleberries. So this is something that's not just something that we eat or, you know, we like to do, but it's an integral part of our culture and our religion. So we have a culture based on and defined by salmon. This might be true of some of you out there as well. But for a lot of the tribes in the area, salmon fishing is more than just a cultural subsistence issue, like I said before, or an economic act, which is also a big part of tribal culture these days, is economics, although the runs haven't been so well in the last few years. But the tribes view salmon as an extension of life and is an indicator of environmental health. And the loss of the salmon is equated with the loss of our tribal identity and culture. And this is very true when we talk about tribes who have lost access to salmon completely. So above in Upper Washington, the Spokane, if you go further up to the First Nations in Canada, they've lost, because of these big dams that have been built, they've lost access to salmon completely. And with that loss has been the loss of some of their songs, some of their prayers, some of their traditions and cultural practices. So it can be really devastating, and those people have felt it, and it's been really hard. So we've been working with them, and they've been doing a lot of effort to get fish and salmon back into those rivers. So Tamunwit goes back to many of what your interests are. I'm sure maybe why you're here is conservation and stewardship, and Tamunwit is inherent. Those words are inherent in how we live and how we manage our resources. For us, our natural resources are our cultural resources. There's no distinction between the two. And that goes back to the first treaty with the Creator. So we responded with the natural cycle We didn't always live in one place. We moved with the seasons. In the spring, we'd be down on the river catching salmon. In the summers, we'd be up in the mountains where it's nice and cool, digging bitter roots and picking huckleberries. In the fall, we'd be downriver or in the lowlands. And then in the winter, we would be near the river too, come into these big winter lodges, is what they would call them. So it'd be a larger congregation of families or tribes or bands coming together and then dispersing out when the spring, summer, and fall came to be. Again, it's like we think about Tamunwa, it's our obligation to speak on behalf of the resources that can no longer speak because of our presence. And it's a responsibility that we have for not just ourselves today, but for all those future generations, seven down, five down the road. So the reason there are four tribes I work for have come together is because of the treaties of 1855. And in those treaties, our leadership, our ancestors recognized the need for the continuance of our culture and tradition through the gathering and the fishing of our first foods. And so they made sure that in that treaty language, that was reserved. And so these are reserved rights. These weren't rights that were granted to us. We have always retained these rights. All of these are in our treaties. We have the right to take fish at all usual and accustomed places. This means outside the reservation boundaries, so in our ceded territories as a whole, together with the privilege of hunting, gathering roots and berries. So our leadership knew at the time that we would cease to be the people we were if we didn't have these first foods and these resources and this culture and these practices. And that's treaty still holds up to this day. So there are 10 treaties signed in that year. Oregon, Washington, and Idaho didn't even become states until after these treaties. So these treaties predate statehood, which is why we also have, as sovereign nations, we have self-determination to establish our own government, our own jurisdiction, and we have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government, not with the state. These people, especially the people on the river, had to move. They were removed from the river, and some refused to go, but onto reservations. And they all became different. At the time, you know, there was, you know, hundreds of different tribes and bands around the whole area, the Columbia Plateau. But for my tribe, we are 14 different tribes and bands that were all lumped together and called the Yakima. For the Umatilla tribe, there's three of them, the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla. For the Warm Springs tribes, there's three of them as well. And then the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho was the only one that was able to remain alone. But it changed the way things were done, because at the time, we had all been intermarrying. We were all families. And so by putting these borders and these distinctions against these tribes, it really changed the culture. So where are we talking here? So again, the Yakimas in Washington, more than 25% of our ceded territory encompasses the basin, and over half of which are still accessible to salmon, which is a really big deal if you think about what I was telling you about other tribes who have lost that access completely. In 1957, the Dalles Dam inundated Wyom, which is our word for Celilo Falls. We have tribal members today, tribal members on my commission, who talk about Celilo, who remember it, and they remember it as you could hear the roaring of the river 20 miles away. It was that huge. It was just so immense and such a huge place for our people to gather, and that completely went underground after Celilo went in. So when it inundated completely this area, this traditional area of ours. So it also forced relocation of all of our homes, all of the villages that had been there. There were promises made by the Army Corps of Engineers to build homes for the tribal members who had been there. Still to this day have not been fulfilled. We have what we call treaty fishing access sites, inlu and treaty fishing access sites. So there are 31 places along the river where we can access, where tribal members can access the river to launch boats or to put up scaffolding for fishing, but they're not habitable. There's people who live on them because they have no other option, but these are still promises made by the government in the 50s that have not been come to fruition, and it's something that we're continuing to fight for to this day. So there's legislation, there's us working with the administration. Nothing's going on right now, as you can imagine. It's really hard for anything to get funded or passed. But it's just a testament to how, one, promises were not fulfilled, but at the same time, how resilient our tribal members continue to be.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 6 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a master's degree in public administration for those who want to create more efficient and inclusive cities, government agencies, and nonprofits. More information at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen the documentary film Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Once a pesticide is banned in the United States for its dangerous health and environmental effects, companies are still permitted to manufacture it for export only. Circle of Poison documents the export of dangerous pesticides and the inspiring ways communities are fighting back. Again, that's Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the live performance of the West Lynn Radio Hour, KWL 1956, on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Youth Music Project in West Lynn. For the past 3 years, the West Lynn Historical Society has produced the KWL radio show. This year, the reenactment will feature a roundup of the news, West Lynn history on parade, as the Willamette Flow soap opera, and more. Again, that's a live performance of the West Lynn Radio.